Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. In just a moment, we'll be talking through all the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau, and then we're going to go right on in to our sponsor interview. And this week's show is brought to you by Thinxt Canary. Thinxt founder Haroon Mir will be along in this week's show to talk about the effect venture capital is having on the security ecosystem. He thinks VC money often makes weak ideas look strong, and in a market where it's sometimes quite difficult to make informed purchasing decisions, that's not a good thing. So that is an interesting chat, and it is coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, I guess, you know, the big story of the last week is old mate Julian Assange dragged out of the Ecuadorian embassy for the charge of having a succulent Chinese meal. Dragged out of the embassy, and he got vanned by Edward Snowden described as the UK's secret police, which, if true, they're not very good at being the secret police, considering their van had police written on it and there were a bunch of people standing around wearing uniforms that said police on them, even had hats that said police.
Geordie hats and everything, yeah.
Talk about your hattribution. But yeah, I mean, look, his stay in Ecuador, in the Ecuadorian embassy, is over, and I'd imagine he's moved on to some upgraded quarters.
It's probably not going to get to have a cat in this one, though. But no. Yeah, I think we were all sort of expecting it. I mean, after the change of government in Ecuador, and they, you know, they were definitely getting a bit more frosty, a little bit sick of his shit, I imagine, is the technical term. They invited the police in, they dragged him out. The internet had a lot of fun captioning the gifts, and it sounds like he's going to get extradited. That seems to be where this is heading.
Yeah, so he has been charged, and who would have predicted, Adam, that he's actually been charged for computer crime offences, specifically entering into an agreement with Chelsea Manning to crack a hash that she had provided to him. Now, there's no allegation that he was actually successful there, but the idea was that he would crack this hash for her, and then she could use this other account to try to help anonymize her so that she could collect these documents without people knowing that it was her. And it turns out that's not really very legal.
Yeah, no, they're charging him under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and offering to crack a hash is part of being a computer criminal, and that's what he's what he's charged with. So it's interesting, I guess, the lack of other charges. Like, that's, I mean, people have been wondering whether we'd see it for handling classified documents or, a bunch of the other things. And it does seem like they've tried to sidestep a lot of the complicated issues by charging him with, workaday basic bitch computer hacking.
Yeah, basically, right? So there's a few things to unpack here. First of all, if he is extradited under this charge, that is the only charge he will face in the United States. That's how extraditions work. But I do believe there is some talk that the US has up to 65 days to actually lodge fresh charges before the extradition. Right. So I'm not 100% sure on that, but that seems to be what the internet is saying. And there's a few interesting aspects to this. So one of them is that there is actually a 5-year limitation on that charge, like a 5-year statute of limitation on that charge, unless it is connected to a federal crime of terrorism, which Bobby Chesney will explain in a moment. This kind of is. So, yeah, I spoke to Bobby and I asked him a few questions. So I asked him, is the extradition likely to proceed, and what are his chances of actually getting acquitted here? I mean, couldn't he just say, I was just working Manning and I didn't actually intend to crack the hash, stuff like that? Anyway, here's what Bobby Chesney had to say.
The regular limitations period is 5 years, which would be too late, but there are some statutes that extend the deadline, including one that's focused on terrorism that moves the limitations period to 8 years. The way that one works is it lists a bunch of specific crimes that are found in the terrorism-related part of U.S. criminal law, and one of these is a statute that nominally focuses on transnational terrorism. But there's a catch. That statute has within it a definition that includes and incorporates a long list of other crimes, and one of them, surprise, surprise, is the part of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that's specific to hacking to steal national defense information. So on one hand, that's obviously not a scenario that normally involves actual terrorism, and not in this case either. But on the other hand, the statute very clearly does incorporate that provision, and it's applicable here. Now, does that open the door for a court to conclude that this extradition attempt is actually a disguised political offense that would prevent extradition? I very much doubt it. So I think he will be extradited.
On the criminal agreement to crack the hash, which is the heart of the conspiracy charge, could Assange argue that he never actually intended to crack it and he was just plain Manning? In theory, sure, he could try that, but I think it'd be impossible to convince a jury that that was his real mental state at the time. He'd have to have some, and I think this is very unlikely, really objective evidence that that's what was going on. And that raises the question, what defense will the guy have? And I'd say he won't have much of one. I think that what he'll do is he'll do his best within the limitations of evidence law and what the judge allows to try to put the U.S. government itself on trial and to try to frame this as an assault on journalism, even if it's indirect, and just hope for jury sympathy, maybe even what we call jury nullification, where the jury declines to convict even though the charge actually was proven.
That was Bobby Chesney there, who is, of course, the co-founder of the Lawfare blog, the co-host of the National Security Law podcast, which is excellent if you're interested in these sorts of things. And he is, of course, a law guy at the University of Texas, Austin. So, I mean, what Bobby seems to be saying there is you really wouldn't want to be Assange right now.
No, I think that's probably true of any time in the last, you know, 10 years as well.
Interesting fact here is that these, you know, alleged offences occurred in 2010 and they weren't charged until November 2017. So, but I mean, it's all lined up for the DOJ, right? Like they can actually charge this, as we've just heard.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, obviously they wouldn't have really pushed for it if they didn't think they had a chance. I mean, from the U.S. government point of view, I imagine, you know, seeing Assange walk free and then crowing about it, you know, is not a thing that they would really want to see happen. So I'm sure they've been working to make sure that, you know, all the ducks do, in fact, line up in their favor.
Now, look, you know, Bobby just mentioned that Assange will probably seek to put the U.S. government on trial. We've already got a bit of an indication here of how his supporters are going to run this, right? The Juice News, they do rap news and stuff, very much aligned with WikiLeaks. They put out a video in the last couple of days on the Assange arrest. I just want to play a bit of an excerpt of it here. So have a listen to this. This is, we can expect a lot of this is what I'm getting at. Here we go.
Hello, I'm from the U.S. government. We're grateful to all our bitches for handing over David Letterman, I mean Julian Assange, who's wanted on charges of making us look like war criminals. Which, of course, we are. We have indicted the accused for the crime of helping his source to anonymously access documents in the public interest, otherwise known as good journalism. Journalists, of course, are not supposed to be good. They're meant to be piss-weak on questioning stenographers who publish what we tolerate. By extraditing a foreign journalist, we hope to send a clear warning to all journalists not to mess with our We ask all of you to cooperate with us in setting this dangerous precedent by focusing on how the accused is a bit of an asshole instead of our attempt to destroy your press freedom.
So there you go. I mean, that's clearly going to be the line of attack there, that this is an attack on press freedoms. I mean, personally, I don't see it because, you know, I am a journalist. I have been a journalist for a long time. I know lots of journalists and they're not going to be running around offering to crack passwords for sources because it's clearly illegal, right? Like no one's that dumb. Look, I can't rule out that it's ever happened, but I would be surprised if this is something that people would do without recognizing that it was illegal.
Yeah, it certainly does seem like it crosses some kind of line of separation between, you know, what the journalist's role is and you know, the things that they're, the separation from what they're actually reporting on. So, yeah, I don't know. I'd be surprised to see that happen. But then what's funny, though, about that Juice News bit is, you know, it, even they admit that he's kind of an asshole. Like, geez, when those people say it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I feel. To be quite honest, I don't actually know how I feel about these charges because they are a little bit weak sauce, right? Then again, I mean, considering the grief that he put the US government through, and given that there is something that, you know, if proven is a bit of a, you know, is a pretty easy charge and that a crime was committed, I mean, it's hard to sort of blame them for charging it. If you're going to do something like what he did, don't commit crimes when you're doing it, you know? And at the end of the day, too, this is attempted computer crime. Like, no one alleges that he was successful in cracking this hash, right? So just the mere fact that his judgment was off and he did actually enter into what they're alleging is a criminal conspiracy, you know, that's going to be enough. So I just can't say I'm surprised. And I'm wary of people saying that this sets some sort of dangerous precedent. I mean, what precedent does it set? Don't ask sources, you know, for hashes that you're going to crack. Like, what are we worried about here?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's a lot of abuse of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that we've seen in the past. And this, you know, you're right, it is a little flimsy in the sense that, you know, there wasn't a lot of computer hacking going on. But, Yeah. I don't know. You're right. It does seem like it's such a sort of a straightforward and
it strikes me as DOJ saying, we got this, why not?
Yeah. And I mean, to a certain extent, right, he's been stuck in essentially a jail cell for the last 7 years anyway. You know, I imagine, you know, expending a whole bunch of effort to try and throw him away for, I mean, what can this charge possibly be worth in terms of jail time for attempting to
grab cash? It's five years.
Yeah, right. So not exactly, you know, going to put him away for life or anything. And maybe at some point the DOJ is just like, well, you know, we just don't care that much.
Yeah, had he have been immediately charged and with this offence, you know, he would have been out years ago, even if he was convicted the maximum time.
If he'd handed himself in back then yeah, he'd be done.
Now, of course, there's a lot of talk about whether or not he's going to wind up in Sweden to face the rape allegations, which, you know, they were sort of discontinued. These investigations were discontinued because they couldn't get access to him, and there's a bit of talk that they might come back. One thing that's occurred to me is a lot of stuff has happened since those allegations were first made. Now, you know, for those who don't remember, a couple of women accused Assange of various, you know, degrees of sexual assault, and he immediately sort of tarred them as being CIA collaborators and all of this ridiculous stuff. Now, I think, given that we've had the Me Too movement, how do you think he'd go running that line again? Because I don't think it'd work quite so well this time. Not that it should have worked in the first place.
No, of course not. But I think the, you know, the intersection of interests between, you know, the sorts of, you know, Anons and WikiLeaks people and, you know, Me Too now, I think it would be a very different environment to try and play that out. And yeah, you would imagine that, you know, that wouldn't have gone as it did back then. I think you're right. It's a different environment now. And yeah, it might well have been, you know, a thing that he wouldn't consider now. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, look, moving on. And Krebs has a great story here about a breach at an IT, one of those, you know, massive Indian IT outsourcing firms called Wipro, which looks like, you know, state-sponsored activity, according to his sources.
Yeah, the story appears to go that somebody had owned them and then was using it as a jumping off point into a bunch of their downstream customers. Obviously, you know, being a very big outsourcing firm, they have a lot of customers. Krebs reached out to them and got the brush off, basically saying, we have lots of multi-level security, we take it very seriously. And then, yeah, it turns out they're rolling IR because they got well and truly owned. And, you know, this kind of attack through supply chain, especially with outsourced, you know, IT consultancy firms, is absolutely a thing we've seen nation states doing, and of course everyone else as well, because it really works, and it's just not good. Not good.
I think they were trying to minimize it on their earnings call too, and Brian was on it and sort of popped up saying, well, actually, you know, so
When Krebs is on your earnings call, you're gonna have a bad time.
Oh man, like talk about just going out of your way to piss in the punch. So that's an interesting one, kind of an evolving situation. Silk Road 2, the founder, Dread Pirate Roberts 2, turns out he was arrested, you know, quite some time ago, and now he's just been sentenced to something like 5 years in prison in the UK. A little bit different to DPR1, who got sentenced to forever years in prison. So I'm sure he's, you know, I'm guessing he'd be quite relieved that he's not going to prison forever. But it turns out this guy is like, you know, something of a, you know, minor InfoSec Twitter celebrity.
Yeah, apparently he was, whilst out on bail after being initially arrested, has become somewhat of a pundit on privacy issues and security stuff. I didn't recognise the name myself, but...
I did. CthulhuSec on Twitter, who was often posting guides on, like, how to spin up, you know, onion services and things like that. But he got done, like, it was the Bitcoin that did him in, I think, and the fact that the FBI sort of followed him from Silk Road 1 to Silk Road 2, you know, because Silk Road 2 was basically set up by the feds.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a you know, classic story of how OPSEC is a thing you need to have before you need it. This guy got traced. He was originally active on Silk Road 1 and then, you know, started Silk Road 2 and ran that with a bunch of other people, some of whom were feds. But yeah, they traced him from like the original transaction that he used to load Bitcoin into his original Silk Road account, and then were able to kind of follow that trail all the way onwards through to then becoming DPR2 and running Silk Road 2, which, yeah, just really goes to show how important OPSEC is and how, you know, those sort of marketplaces where your reputation and your name are kind of part of what allows you to do business is also very much the liability of those platforms, because establishing a chain over time is what lets them track you down and attribute to you.
Yeah, apparently this guy was planning on setting up a you know, paid membership child exploitation material website. So, you know, glad he's in prison. Sucks to be you, dude. Hope you have a shit one. Let's see. Last week we spoke about the, you know, the shady lady at Mar-a-Lago, the Chinese lady who was arrested with a million mobile phones and malware-riddled USB sticks. Turns out the malware on the USB stick might have actually been a false positive, according to this story by Reuters. And a number of outlets are reporting this.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of twist to it. They're saying that either it was a false positive or, you know, maybe there was some kind of, you know, self-destruction mechanism or something else or some other complexity in the story. Anyway, it doesn't seem to be exactly as we originally laughed about on Twitter, you know, a week and a half ago when the story broke.
Yeah, but I mean, the judge is like, you were clearly doing something nefarious. Like, she was up to something. People just don't know what it is yet.
Yeah, and the judge at least has denied her bail on the basis that she was up to something nefarious. So, yeah, it would be interesting to see how this particular story does play out. She has pled not guilty, so, you know, that's starting.
Would suck for her if she's just like a super eccentric tourist, you know? Who's now well, the center of a massive counterintelligence investigation just because they're a weirdo, yeah. You know? You never know. You just do,
right?
Never know.
And that's certainly what the defense attorney is saying, right? That if there was a decent Mandarin interpreter available, then none of this would have happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, let's keep an eye on that one. Now, look, we spoke about some of these bugs last week, right, in WordPress. The whole WordPress ecosystem is basically on fire right now. You know, I even linked through to a Twitter thread from Social Warfare, which is a plugin maker, you know, and all of their angry customers because they all their customers were getting owned. And so one of the things that's happening right now is there's this security researcher who's gotten into a pissing match with the people who run like some of the WordPress forums. And so he's now running around just dropping ODAY left, right, and center, which is promptly being scooped up and used by some pretty organized crews. And it's just a mess. We've even got Mark Maunder from WordFence, which is one of the, you know, WordPress security companies. We had one of their guys quoted on last week's show. He's like, we should criminalize this sort of behavior, which is funny because I know Mark and he kind of falls more on the liberal side of the political spectrum. And he's like, throw him in prison. But it is a bad situation, right? And this person is certainly not a good faith actor.
No, and I think, you know, there's been lots of hand-wringing on InfoSec Twitter about, you know, free, you know, full disclosure and whether or not this is, you know, straight-up criminal activity or whatever else. And, you know, all the various shades of the kind of disclosure debate. But yeah, you're like, in the end, it does come down to the fact there's one guy is making life really unpleasant for a lot of people because of his own beef about having his forum posts moderated. You know, for God's sake, grow up, you know. So, you know, I don't think we necessarily need to draw conclusions about full disclosure from this particular, you know, really kind of stupid case.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like at some point I feel like the disclosure, the responsible disclosure thing is going to come back because something like this is going to happen and there's going to be a really bad result. You know, beyond a few blogs getting owned, I just sort of feel like this is the sort of shit that risks dragging this boring, tired, had a million times debate back into the you know, public consciousness. I just don't want to see that happen. Sick of talking about it.
No, I mean, I agreed, right? It is a pretty tired old topic. And you know, for me, I feel like the real concerns is, you know, a bit later on, I think, in the list of news, we've got an opinion about, you know, the fact that there's so much more Office malware and the fact that Office proof-of-concept Office bugs get weaponized and used by nation-state actors for real bad, you know, really, really quickly. And that there is, you know, the argument for full disclosure there, that there is a benefit to protecting users, really doesn't hold true in that case. Whereas, you know, out here in the, you know, just skirmishing on forums bullshit, it's kind of, you know, just people being dicks, where there are certainly cases where you could argue that full disclosure isn't helpful. You know, isn't as helpful as we would like it to be. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, it's a debate we're going to have again.
Yeah, great. PPD20, right. This was the rules governing, you know, when Cyber Command could do stuff. It was a complicated interagency process. You know, PPD20 was replaced with a somewhat more frictionless process when Cyber Command wants to go and deploy the
internet weapon.
So we got a piece here from CyberScoop, which says that PPD20, that the successor to PPD20 has yielded, quote, operational success.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there was a lot of overhead in trying to balance all the equities and all the various considerations and various hats involved in the Obama era process. You know, the National Security Presidential Memorandum 13, the one that replaced it, does seem to be allowing them to be a bit more YOLO about things. And, I mean, you know, given that some of these internet weapons, you know, do have a shelf life and it does kind of make sense to use them before you lose them, you know, yeah.
I don't know that that's the rationale. I think it's just about, like, I don't know. I think it's just about freeing them up a bit. And it looks like, you know, certainly when they, you know, knocked the IRA offline on election day, seems to me like more that sort of stuff. I don't think it's about the toolkits per se. But look, speaking of internet weapons, I'm going to use that one a few times today because, you know, this week's news, it's all like bugs and malware. Like it's good bread and butter InfoSec stuff. We had the stuff about Assange. That's done. Let's talk about this stuff. FireEye has done a really great bunch of research into the crew behind the Triton ICS malware, but they're more looking at the steps these attackers are taking before they're deploying their internet weapon. And, you know, they're sort of mapping those steps onto the attack, MITRE attack matrix. It's interesting stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Triton or Trisys malware and crew that's carrying out the attacks is a really, really interesting, you know, bit of the industry. And we just haven't had a whole bunch of information about, you know, where it's been deployed. We've seen some details, I guess, about one of the oil refineries in Saudi Arabia that got attacked once upon a time. But, I mean, there's people being attacked by this particular set of malware, which is targeting industrial safety systems, like the sorts of things that are the last resort before your, you know, your oil plant goes boom. And this is, you know, one of the few families of malware that's specifically engineered to target those systems and to provide the capability to manipulate them so that they do go boom. So really interesting thing. But yeah, we've just always been really vague about how it's getting there. And this is what FireEye has been talking about, is looking into the crews that, you know, have been getting into, you know, the corporate networks around these systems and then expending the time and effort and research necessary to go worm your way into the point where you could then deploy the payload, which is, you know, this Triton malware that you can then presumably keep on the shelf for when you really need that capability. And that's kind of, you know, what it feels like to me, because we haven't seen it used to really blow anything up yet.
Well, they did try. They did try at one point. I think that was the Saudi example, and it didn't work. They screwed something up. But I mean, whether or not they're actually using it or not, it's pretty aggressive putting this stuff out there. It's a no-no. I mean, they've linked this one to Russia.
Yeah, and it feels to me like the preparing the battle space thing, right? Having the capability in place when you need it. But then, of course, the temptation is once you've got it, then you might want to use it. And yeah, that's...
See, to me, this goes beyond sort of operating environment preparation, right? Like this is beyond that. It's too aggressive. It's too kinetic. Potentially kinetic. It's like smuggling a bomb under these plants on a remote trigger. You know what I mean? Like it is just too, it's too far advanced to be considered just run of the mill readiness. So I just look, the reason I'm taking on a bit of a somber tone is I don't want to see things going boom because of it. But look, we got plenty of news to get through. People can chase through the week's show notes and find the wide article, and then of course links out to FireEye material on that. Apparently, the DHS, you know, speaking of Russian threat actors, the DHS and the FBI say elections systems in every single state in the United States were targeted in 2016, which is yeesh.
Yeah, DHS and the FBI have released one of their joint intelligence bulletins talking about the reconnaissance that was done ahead of the 2016 elections. There isn't any real new technical information in here, although there's a couple of amusing bits, like the fact that the timeline of activity suggests they were working off an alphabetical list of U.S. states.
That's pretty funny.
Which, you know, does, you know, kind of make you think that someone had a meeting and then got given some tasking. And, I mean, it kind of, you know, it's not just, you know, some teenager in the basement, as people might have said in the past. But, yeah, I think mostly this is about, you know, the DHS preparing the battle space for the 2020 elections, you know, just trying to, you know, build up some credibility with the various, you know, state operators of election environments.
So there you go. There you go. Security tip for Alaska. You can change your name to Zalaska, and you know, you can be last in the queue to get hosed by the Russians. Now we've got another good one from CyberScoop this week, looking at some activity in Ukraine that looks to be Russian in origin.
Yeah, this is about a campaign, you know, targeting a bunch of government agencies in Ukraine that is being attributed to like a non-state actor from, you know, sort of the breakaway bit of Ukraine that Russia is occupying, and the Luhansk region. Apparently there's a Luhansk People's Republic that's behind this particular one. The campaign is not particularly sophisticated. They made some, you know, kind of basic mistakes that appear to have got them snapped. But yeah, kind of interesting seeing this being, you know, you don't really know whether it's just the straight up Russians pretending to be some splinter group or whether it is actually, you know, kind of indigenous to that region.
Switching gears for a second, and Australia's signals director at the ASD has torn up a recently signed contract with Cloudflare over its decision to continue hosting sites like 8chan.
Yeah, now that's pretty interesting. I mean, obviously the conversation, your rather fiery conversation that you and Alex had, about Cloudflare. In fact, I think even the title of that show was Stop Giving Cloudflare Money.
Yeah.
Stop Giving Cloudflare Money. So, yeah, interesting seeing some kind of fallout after that. And, it's not an unreasonable thing, especially if you're a government agency like ASD, to make your feelings known with your wallet. Because, I mean, in the end, that's what, corporate entity like Cloudflare really is going to pay attention to is consumers voting and moving elsewhere.
Moving on, and we're going to talk about a bug now, right? And the reason we're talking about this bug, it's nearly a month old. It's in Confluence, the Atlassian product. And the reason we're talking about this is, a lot of listeners would know that I'm working pretty closely with a startup here, Shubs and Michael, AssetNote, great tech that does a lot of asset discovery and then vuln scanning. So those guys have pretty good visibility into what bugs are prevalent out there. And this bug is everywhere. Now, I wasn't actually going to mention it, but the thing that tipped it for me is a couple of days back, I got some signal messages. My phone number's not hard to find. I started getting some signal messages from someone who works for a European cert. They don't want to be identified, but they're like, hey, can you talk about this Confluence thing on your next podcast? Because it's everywhere. And I'm like, yeah, okay, we're seeing the same thing. This one's a problem. It is absolutely everywhere. It's trivial to exploit. The product doesn't actually check host headers either, so you can exploit it with DNS rebinding. I actually asked Shabam Shah, who is the CTO of AssetNote, to give us a bit of detail on the bug, and here's what he said.
Confluence has a bunch of different widget connectors. And as a part of these widget connectors, some of them have been added in that contain parameters that weren't discovered before. But now it's been found that we can actually include remote templates when calling, in particular, the Friends Feed widget connector. So for a lot of Confluence versions, what seems to be possible is for us to be able to include a remote template that exists on our HTTPS server or FTP server that ends up actually being malicious and then ran on the Confluence server that we are attacking. What's nuts about this bug is that we've done quite a lot of analysis on the global scale, and what we're finding is there's quite a few Confluence servers that are actually vulnerable to this command execution bug at the end of the day. Once you can include these templates, you can then get command execution. And really, for a hacker at this point, you can basically pick and choose what company you want to break into, and it's there.
So yeah, I mean, basically the AssetNote guys, they came up with a SIG for this, fed it into the system, and it just popped up everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Atlassian have done pretty well for themselves.
They sure have. We have proof.
You see Confluence and Jira and a bunch of their other products all over the place. I mean, it really is very widely used. And then this one is interesting, I think, because what you mentioned briefly, you can use DNS rebinding to trigger it as well. So the fact that these things are, not reachable from the outside necessarily is not a, not a thing that's going to stop you getting owned. And that's, obviously, remote code to come to the LAN is the sort of thing us hackers really love. Not surprising it's getting use.
Yeah, well, I mean, the European cert guy said that one complicating factor here is that people he's spoken to seem to think that this is a post-auth bug, and it's not. So this is like straight up pre-auth command injection by including, a malicious template. So I'm just letting people know that that's one we are seeing out there, and you might want to get on top of that, because it's bad whether or not it's accessible externally. So sort it out, will you? Sort it out, people. Wired has an interesting story here about a crew that is doing some cool ATM hacks.
Yeah, there seems to be a crew that's been working through the process of leveraging access to ATMs as part of their attacks in much the same way they've been leveraging the Swift network to do transfers. So if you're on the ATM, obviously you can cash out the ATM, have it dump money. But there's a bunch of other things you can do, once you're in the middle of the network and on the wire in the ATM to try and, have different and diverse ways of cashing out. And obviously, hacking a bank is not complicated. Getting the money out of the bank, that's, the slightly more difficult. So we're seeing, some diversity crop up in how to actually cash out of a bank.
Now, when we spoke last week, the Kaspersky Analyst Summit was in full swing. So, of course, there's been a few more talks delivered since then and the subsequent write-ups. We got one here from Andy Greenberg talking about the Taj Mahal malware.
Yeah, this is a piece of malware that Kaspersky have been talking about, which, you know, has all the hallmarks of being a nation state set of capability. Really full featured implant with all sorts of, you know, things that are quite clearly intelligence gathering focused. You know, a lot of emphasis on being able to exfiltrate specific files from the environment, but also a really modular framework, and, you know, the sort of thing that looks like it's been engineered by professionals. But where it really stands out is apparently no one's ever seen it before. Like, not even, reuse of a few components here and there, like completely clean code base that no one's seen anywhere else before and that has been in the wild for, you know, 5 or 6 years for some of the components, if the metadata is to be believed. So that's kind of interesting, you know, that there's a new player or a new department in one of the existing players.
Yeah.
You know,
someone competent, I think, is the main thing here.
Yes, right. And that's managed to keep their nose clean, you know, long enough to deploy this.
Any idea who this one might be? I mean, I'm thinking with a name like Taj Mahal.
Well, I mean, okay, so it's called Taj Mahal, but a bunch of the components are called like Yokohama and stuff. So maybe Kaspersky's just messing with us there. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, this story you alluded to before, but Kaspersky, has an interesting stat here. And they're saying that 70% of attacks now target, office vulnerabilities. And, I'm guessing a lot of that's going to be embedded OLE objects. Is that right?
Yeah, we have seen a real uptick in a bunch of techniques like that, embedded OLE objects. There was that Microsoft Equation Editor, like the really ancient component that they only had that they'd lost the source code for. There was a bunch of bugs in that people were exploiting. There's a graph actually that Kaspersky provided, which was showing the breakdown of targets between 2016 and 2018. And yeah, it's gone from 15-16% office to 70% office. And part of that's obviously browsers have gotten a lot better. Flash has got a lot more dead. Java has gotten more dead. And yeah, Office, you know, there's a lot of people who don't want to move to the cloud Office, don't want to move to the more modern versions. So we're seeing people stay on old versions of Office for a lot longer than they should. Plus, of course, you know, we have to go as attackers to the targets that work, and Office is working for people. I think this, this kind of lines up with what we've seen as well. Definitely, if you're running Office, you might want to make sure that you're not running ancient ones.
Now, some time ago, we saw a European Commission text that said that, Kaspersky was confirmed as malicious. Turns out, not so.
Yeah, some Belgian member of the European Parliament actually went and asked them to provide some specifics about, you know, why they had classified Kaspersky as a malicious, confirmed malicious entity. After some rummaging around, they have shuffled their feet for a while and said, actually, we don't have any evidence, but we still don't like Kaspersky.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, do you need to see the evidence, or do you really just want to run a Russian rootkit on your box? Like, and I'm not saying, look, the thing is, right, like, Kaspersky make good software. They've got great researchers. I know people. I've met so many people who work there, all really good people. But, you know, unfortunately, they're operating in the wrong country. So I think that's just the thing that we have to bear in mind. It's unfortunate, but it is what it is. DHS has put out an alert on, it's been a bad week for VPNs, man.
Yeah, they put out an alert talking about a bunch of VPN configuration issues, or a bunch of issues with VPN clients where, you know, they're storing cache key material in the config files and things like that, which are not, you know, not technical bugs that are going to let you break into a VPN server, but obviously things that, they wouldn't be publishing alerts if attackers weren't actually, you know, using this kind of thing to obtain VPN session keys and then, you know, nip up people's VPNs and into people's networks.
But we should mention too, these are enterprise VPN products, things like Cisco, F5, Palo Alto, Pulse, right? Like, this is serious business.
Yeah, although, I mean, anyone who's ever used one of those enterprise VPNs will have been, you know, gone to the login page and been, you know, had a ancient Java install from, you know, 2014 dropped on their machine to make it worse in the name of security. So enterprise doesn't mean a whole bunch in my experience of enterprise VPNs.
We got another one from Krebs here. And, you know, it's just one of those really interesting stories about how crime groups can create some pretty awesome tools to separate victims from their money. This is a service called Landlords, which enables you to basically duplicate Airbnb so that, you know, you put up some listings on Airbnb, but eventually you can, like, redirect people to your fake Airbnb and scam them out of money.
Yeah, Krebs always has a really good line on these sort of, you know, very niche, you know, but quite sophisticated crime products that people end up flogging on the various forums. I mean, this thing will actually, like, automate the process of like scraping existing listings of Airbnb and making fake ones for you and generating fake reviews and all this kind of thing to astroturf up you know, what looks like believable lived-in Airbnb offerings, and then, yeah, facilitate the process of scamming them, which, you know, pretty smooth, I guess.
Oh, apparently someone's gone out there and published, you know, they've doxed thousands of US police officers and federal agents, which I'm just thinking, I mean, is this the 2019 equivalent of come at me, bro? That's got to be a bad idea.
Yeah, this does seem rather poorly thought out. This crowd that's been selling data on various darknet forums or whatever hacked a bunch of like FBI, it was the FBI National Academy Association, which is kind of like a some kind of sort of
alumni group, isn't it?
Alumni group. Yeah, that's a good thing, a good way of putting it. For FBI officers, which, yeah, it does seem like a pretty sure way to have a target painted on yourself. And, you know, this group's also selling a bunch of information from other hacked sites and things. But yeah, this does seem like a, I mean, this is the one that's getting reported on. So clearly it's getting them attention.
Yes, yes. All sorts of attention, I would imagine. And a former IT worker from the US Senate, like an intern, has admitted to doxing a bunch of Republican senators in the US because they were pissed off about the Kavanaugh hearing.
Yeah, they apparently, this guy obtained, you know, like phone numbers and home address details and stuff of some of the people that were in the US government that he was pissed off at, and then went to their Wikipedia pages and just like put their phone numbers in the Wikipedia pages. Which,
it would be funnier if it wasn't dangerous, right?
Well, exactly, right? Because, I mean, people are going to use these things to, yeah, we don't know what people are going to use it for. And yes, it could very well turn out dangerous for people. But then he also, like, did it from the Senate, like, from people's offices there. And then people, like, saw him doing it. Like, I'm surprised this guy, you know, lasted even this long before getting rolled up.
Yeah, very angry person by the looks of things. And, you know, we got a hacker out there called Gnostic Players who is trying to hit their own personal target for the number of records that they've actually managed to steal.
Yeah, this guy's apparently going for 1 billion credentials that he's attempting to steal and sell on Dream Market. I think given Dream Market's going out of business pretty soon, he'll have to get on it. But yeah, he's been working through. I don't know if he's quite made his billion yet. But yeah, this guy's been – people have been kind of making fun of him because he's been, you know, hacking fairly low-rent sites, let's be honest. And, you know, you do enough of those, you still start to get the numbers. But it's not exactly glamorous work.
Not glamorous work. There you go. This looks to be interesting. Google has developed a tool here. Now, I'm not quite sure. Is this something they're releasing to the public, or is this just something they're using internally?
So it sounds like many Google tools, this is a thing that started internally, and it looks like they're going to then make it available for other people to use. This is like a data loss prevention product, I guess, where you define a bunch of sensitive data that you care about, and then Google's built a bunch of tools to, you know, rummage through the data that you're storing to try and identify places where that's ended up that you didn't expect it. And obviously lots of people have done DLP in the past, but I mean, Google's got some tricks up their sleeve for, you know, for example, spotting data in images, you know, where there's screenshots of sensitive data, for example. And if you've got all of your data already in Google's cloud, then, you know, you don't have to go and find out how to get it into the DLP product and that kind of thing. So yeah, you can see where they're heading with this. And
it can go through photos and stuff like that. And I think that's a really good idea. Like, I just bought a car very recently, and you know, it was interstate. It was a sort of, you know, pretty specialist rig. And you know, I have to do things like send them scans of my license and things like that. And you know, you always try to remember to delete that stuff afterwards. But I'm sure there's like scans of my license in my Gmail sent items somewhere.
Oh, yeah, absolutely right. There's loads of places where you end up with that kind of thing, you know, pictures of your passport or pictures of your credit card or your driver's license. Yeah, it would be nice to be able to understand where those things were personally, but also, you know, as a business, when you're, you know, if your customer service people are ending up getting that kind of data delivered to them and you don't want to be liable for having to hold it, or, you know, how many hotels have copies of people's credit card numbers on bits of scanned paper and stuff like that? So yeah, seems like a thing that would be interesting in certain niches. But, you know, on the other hand, DLP is one of those things that, you know, there's a lot of other things you should probably do right before you start using that particular hammer on your security problems.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, if it's something that you can just throw at your Gmail inbox, that's handy. Or just, you know, on your local hard drive, whatever. It's cool. It sounds like this will, yeah, I dig it. Anyway, moving on. Speaking of customer service people, Microsoft having a bad time. Microsoft having a very bad time. Some of their customer service people got their accounts owned, and that enabled some attackers to get, you know, essentially metadata, though, on Microsoft users. They weren't able to get message content, but they could see things like, you know, basic like inbox view, you know, who was receiving email from who, what the subjects were, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so this is Microsoft mailed out to a bunch of their customers who use Outlook.com and Hotmail.com. So yeah, people were, the attackers in this particular case had been in the environment something like 6 months and were able to see at very least metadata, those subjects and to and from of people's emails. But some of the reporting did suggest that there was some cases where they were also able to access content. I mean, one of the sets of reporting was talking about that this was a criminal crew using it to facilitate, say, password reset of Apple Apple accounts, Apple iCloud accounts to unlock stolen iPhones so they could then get the full value. We talked, I think, a few months ago about that kind of interesting niche of the ecosystem. So clearly they had some access. Microsoft's been a little bit they've changed the story a couple of times as more information has come to light. But, I mean, certainly anytime you've got your email stored up in the cloud, you know, it's a real concern when people are having access to it, be it customer services people or, you know, hackers through any mechanism. We have seen a lot of people giving Microsoft some stick for this one just because of the obvious question is, well, how could they log in? I mean, how could you fish customer, or how could you obtain credentials of customer service?
Yeah, where's your 2FA? What's going on?
Or
yeah.
Did it, you know, was there multi-factor and it got relayed or you know, man in the middle somehow? Yeah, we'd like to see some more information, and certainly Microsoft.
I think you know the answer to that question. Like, really, come on. Was it some sort of elaborate 2FA redirection effort? No, they were probably just using username and password.
I was trying to be nice.
We got a skateboarding dog this week, and this one's a doozy. This one's fantastic. You open up your new bit of Apple gear. I mean, not everyone who listens is going to be an Apple user, but, you know, you open up the Apple stuff and it always says, designed in California, which, you know, all of us understand to mean made in China. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
But Fortinet got busted kind of, you know, doing basically the same thing with a bunch of tech that it sold off to the US military. But, you know, it was all designed in the United States and assembled in America. But yeah, they got in a bit of trouble for that because it was all Chinese made gear.
Yeah, this is really just not a good story about supply chain at all. I mean, there's some suggestion that, you know, there was some of that kind of, you know, we assembled it here, but of course it's made out of parts from China. There was also this guy that got fired from Fortinet after the investigation into this, where they were just, you know, slapping on the invoices, oh, this came from our special made in America inventory for selling to the US government, don't worry about it, when in fact actually the stuff was straight out of the factories in China. And that, you know, that kind of mislabeling both of the actual individual products and also of the paperwork around the products, which, I mean, honestly, I'm surprised that they only got fined, what was it, $400,000? They agreed to pay $500,000 to settle these allegations. Like, I'm surprised it's that little. I would have thought a bigger stick would be worth it for this kind of, you know, it's just rude.
Well, you know, they're having to eat this one, right? Like, they don't look great. So I think the publicity around it's going to sting them a little more than the fine. But Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll talk to you again next week. Although I believe next week we are recording on Thursday in Australia and New Zealand time, not Wednesday. So the show will be a day later next week.
Yeah, we've got a little bit of holiday time down here in New Zealand, so I'll be away for a day. But yes, we'll roll a little bit late, and that'll give us an extra day to collect yet more skateboarding dog terribleness.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Before we get going on to this week's sponsor interview, a job listing. Google is currently looking for detection and response engineers to fill positions in Sydney. There are two roles they're looking to fill: security engineer detection and security engineer security and privacy incident response. The detection engineer role is about creating advanced and novel detection mechanisms to detect malicious insiders and outsiders. The detection team develops new detection logic, tools, and infrastructure to help Google find new and evolving threats. The response role is more DFIR, but dealing with a broader set of issues at Google scale. This role looks at outside and inside threats. And I've linked through to full job descriptions in this week's show notes. So yeah, two Google positions there in Sydney that you may be interested in applying for. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Haroon Mir of Thinkst Canary. Thinxt makes what I guess some people call deception technology. They started off with little hardware honeypots that are very easy to deploy. They still sell a bunch of them. But then they moved on to also selling cloud-based virtual honeypots. And you can also manage honey tokens with their platform. It's all really quite simple stuff, which is probably why they're kicking ass and taking names. At the same time that the makers of overly complicated deception technologies are, from what I can tell, mostly dying slow deaths. Now, one key difference in this success story is that Thinxt didn't take any funding. Thinxt was a consultancy before it released its first product, so they bootstrapped it. And today, and this is just my estimation, they would have a value of somewhere between 50 and 100 million US dollars, which is not bad if you happen to own all of it. But I'll tell you something right now, VCs aren't really interested in investing in companies that can get to those sort of valuations. They're chasing insane returns, the big money, the unicorns, which I guess is why they funded a bunch of downright silly deception stuff. And that is, stuff that is insanely complicated and too difficult to deploy. Now, this isn't lost on Haroon. He believes that VCs pumping money into this sector, and I'm not just talking about deception there, security generally, the VCs pumping money into this sector, that often means that bad ideas are giving oxygen when they should just be allowed to die naturally. He's been thinking about this a lot after attending the most recent RSA conference. After he attended RSA last year, he wrote a big blog post actually saying that it was really quite worthwhile, which surprised him, and they did quite well out of it. So to start off this interview, I asked him if that advice that, you know, people should actually bother going to RSA, whether or not that advice still stands. Is RSA still a good place for a smaller vendor like Thinxt to go? Here's what he said.
Yeah, surprisingly, like going in, we were a little bit curious whether it would or whether that's just everyone's first time, but RSA year two was even better than RSA year one in a whole bunch of ways.
One thing that I noticed this year is the content actually seemed to be pretty good, which was surprising.
So the talk seemed better. I don't know if it was always the case, but there were a whole bunch of interesting things. One was I met more hacker researcher friends this year at RSA than I have anywhere else in ages. It was like Black Hat early 2000s. I went to one event and there was Dave Itell, Window Schneider, Halva Flake, Matt Swish, Pedro Mamini, like literally just the who's who of security researchers, Stephen Ridley, everyone was there. My advice to almost everyone coming back, like certainly to other young vendors, I'm saying, pay a little bit of money, get in there, it's worth it.
It is funny that you just rattled off a list of the old guard there, Haroon. So when you describe
yes,
security researchers,
age.
I think it's security researchers of a certain vintage, you know? They're the medium,
yes,
the medium long, guard, not maybe not the old guard.
So long-toothed security researchers. I realize that this is true and suspect this might be my bias.
And they're all running companies now, which is why you're going to run into them at RSA.
Yes, I see that. And I see that. I think it's true. I still think there's interesting stuff happening. So I tweeted when I got back saying, listen, even if you don't come for the show, and like I've still not been for a show, be in town during that week because there's lots of interesting side events going on. And then a bunch of people tweeted back to say, hey, thanks for joining us. This is what we've been doing forever. Like, that's the thing to do during these weeks. And again, I remain surprised. Like, there's still a lot of cringeworthy stuff going on in RSA. There's still the fact that the hall is filled with companies that are probably not going to be there in 3 years. And there's the normal silliness, pin the tail on the donkey stupidity. But there's a lot of interesting stuff happening at the same time also. And certainly if you're a young company, it's a chance to meet customers. And many, many moons ago, Dave Itell wrote a post talking about how at RSA, it's not people selling products, it's people selling companies, saying that everyone comes there to attract VC attention. And that's certainly true.
Well, they're getting it, aren't they? they come to attract the attention and the attention they receive.
Yeah, exactly. And there's VC events, and some of them are straight out of Silicon Valley, the TV series. But there are interesting conversations to be had. And yeah, it brings up the whole discussion of VCs and the effect on the industry. So I've spoken a lot about it in the past because we bootstrapped and we're doing pretty okay. We've got great customers. I think one of the things that need clarity around it, because I've been discussing it more and talking to people more about it, I fundamentally think that VC money hurts the industry, hurts the ecosystem, but not because of VCs fundamentally. Like I think there's a fundamental problem that we have that we keep bumping into, right? Which is customers can't identify largely good versus bad products. They can't differentiate between them. And the problem you have, the thing that RSA brings into sharp relief, is that lots of businesses base their decision based on how legit you look. So if you have ads at airports, ads in in-flight magazines, and teams of nice-suited salesmen, then companies assume you must be doing okay. And the one thing that VC funding allows you to do is put ads in airports, ads in in-flight magazines, and hire teams of salespeople. And so in an industry that can't tell the difference but uses proxies for quality, VC money allows people those proxies, or early VC money. And then you get this self-fulfilling loop, right? Because what happens is a company comes up, its product is fundamentally junk, but they're allowed to put enough paint on it. They walk into companies and they say, we're backed by this VC, we've got all this paint, we've got teams of sales guys, you know our ad, you know our jingle. And so companies say, okay, we'll buy you once. And that initial round of sales then buoys these companies to their next round of funding. And I think it's interesting because it points to a break in the VC model. Because the model on its own does what it does, right? You put money into stuff, and if the stuff works, you put more money into it. And in this case, I think it actually breaks because it looks like it's working for longer than it should. So bad companies last longer than they should. And fundamentally, the problem isn't VCs. The problem is that we still can't distinguish between good or bad companies. The problem is just that VC money makes that harder to tell the difference.
Now, this brings up something for me, right? Like, you know, I sort of have advised various small startups, right? And, you know, this is a conversation that comes up. And there's that pressure to consider funding. And it really does tie into a lot of what you're saying, right? And the pressure can be along these lines. It's, we know we have the best technology, but if someone else comes along with inferior technology, but a better execution, right, as in a bigger marketing spend and more sales firepower, no one gives a shit what's best, right? They just think about what's in front of them, and then you lose despite having the better tech. So this begs the question, right, is the, you know, do you have to play the VC game to win? I like to point to Thinkst and say, well, you don't. But there are certain circumstances, yeah, where time to market is so critical that you're going to have to pull the trigger. And then you've got VC people on your board throwing stupid ideas at you and bad.
You're checking quarterly results. Yeah, it's a good question. And I hear it a lot from people because we've kind of become, like, in our niche of a niche, a reasonable role model for rolling a certain way. And one of the things that make it hard is I can only talk about our data points on this. But from our point of view, it starts early. Like, if you're not burning at an incredible rate, like if you don't start off with 300 developers, then you don't need that much money. And so you have a shorter path to say, well, if we get 10 paying customers, then the lights are on for the next year. Or if we get N paying customers. And so I think a lot of it starts with that. But I'll tell you, when we first started, lots of people spoke to us. And the word everyone uses is, well, there's going to be a land grab. There's going to be a land grab. So you need to be out there, like, build your war chest and go grab land. And I didn't believe it then, and I don't believe it now. And look, like, we don't count ourselves as deception players, but that's generally where we end up being grouped. And all of the other deception guys raised, like, off the top of my head, these most of them raised like between $10 and $30 million. And at the time, like with our raise of $0, I was slightly concerned, like, what does that mean? And some of them had really big name VCs behind them. And if you just take that as the case study, then what we can empirically say is their money and their VCs didn't help them get customers. Our product did.
Well, some of them are gone now, aren't they?
Yeah, some of them are gone. Some of them are circling. But certainly, circling like at this point, yeah, as horrible as that sounds. But like what we do know is we have more customers than most of them combined. And look, I'll say again, and I always say it without any false humility, we were super lucky that our early customers tolerated us while we sucked a little so that we could suck less progressively as we went on. Putting that luck in the corner right now because, hey, my advice to everyone is to be lucky. Like what we can empirically say is that the money and the big name VC in the corner didn't help those people. So I don't think that it turns out that it's not sufficient to win. But look, one of the big moves in the market right now that's different to 10 years ago is the, like it gets talked about a lot in terms of Slack, in terms of GitHub, where you see companies that build engineer-first products, for lack of a better name, getting pulled up into the markets, into customers without the massive sales teams. So previously, if you wanted to sell a source code repository system into an enterprise, you'd need teams of sales guys, like lots, long sales cycle. And now, before the organization CTO realizes what's happening, there's actually 12 paid GitHub accounts and they consolidate it into an enterprise account. Or before you figure out your enterprise communication strategy, you find out there's 50 different Slacks already in your org, already paying money.
That's what happened to them, yeah.
And so we see, like there's a bunch of factors that work for it. One of them being that engineers at companies are more empowered these days. And so you start to see that possibility, which certainly we're the fortunate beneficiary of. Like in many cases, we bought by CISOs and people at the top who've heard about us. But in many cases, it's the engineering team or the devs who said like, hey, we can get the stuff. It's 10K. Let's buy a few and put it in. And then they upsell themselves. So there is there are new laws almost governing the universe that say that you don't have to sell top down. You can go in bottom up. But it means aiming your company and your product differently. And I think it's tough for the old ossified companies who can't adjust to that new reality. But for the new guys who are young and small and starting off, it's a good time to be us.
All right, Haroon Mia, some very, very good advice, I think, for the startup participants who are listening to this podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Always cool. Thanks so much, Pat.
That was Haroon Mia there of Thinkst Canary. You can check them out at canary.tools. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.